Yeah, the Geisha X and the Mama Men singing I Hate Punks. And he's with us in the studio with his wife, Larva, and we would be talking to Geisha about his background in punk rock and some of the other projects that he's working on. And welcome to the Coon Round Report.
Thank you.
May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family.
Oh.
My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson. I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony, coming at you from Skid Row Studios. Our call-in number is 800-893-9562. You want to call in and talk to Gazers and our other guests. Now, this week we will be hearing some creative voices from the community. Geisha X and his wife, Larva, poet Dora Marla. Welcome to the Coon Round Report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, hello, hello.
Yes. Hello.
Now, I want to start off with Geisha X. I'm delighted to have you with us in the studio, Geisha. Geisha X, one of the pioneers of the punk rock scene. Earlene would read something about his background.
Geisha Gideon, born September 28, 1952, professionally known as Geisha X, was a personality in the Los Angeles punk scene in the late 1970s. Geisha produced records for a number of early California punk rock bands, including the Dead Kennedys, the Germs, Black Flag, the Avengers, and the Weirdos. His production of Holiday in Cambodia for the Dead Kennedys and Lexicon Devil for the Germ separated California punk sounds from others at the time when its eccentric humor and smunk making Los Angeles very different than the scenes in New York or London. Record executive Howie Klein, then writing for BAM, a San Francisco music magazine, was quoted as saying, "Geisha X is the only person to capture the West Coast's compelling power and urgency." Geisha also played guitar, sang, and dealt with most studios issues in his band. Geisha X and the Mummy Men, he is credited as having pioneered the use of the headset microphones in music. In 1990s, X opened a recording studio, City Labs, with Josie Cotton, and recorded acts like But Trumpet. He achieved his greatest mainstream success in 1997 when Meredith Brooks' Bitch, which he produced at City Lab, spent 30 weeks on the Billboard Hot 100, peaking at number 2 for 6 weeks.
Okay, Geisha X. Hey, Geisha, can you tell our listening audience about your early background and how did you get into performing?
Well, I always played guitar, you know, when I was young, and then I started to join some bands, and I had this crazy idea of something I called X music, which was this atonal style of music that combined jazz and rock, kind of really hard rock, and I traveled up and down the West Coast and, you know, was kind of talking about strange music and a lot of, you know, recording and stuff, and I ended up in Hollywood and ended up at a place called Artist Recording Studio, which was right before the punk rock movement hit, so I had learned a little bit about recording by the time that punk rock started.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's get a little bit deeper into that discussion. Can you talk about some of the musicians that influenced you?
Well, in the early days, I was very interested in sort of satirical rock and even pop, but I suppose you could say like Frank Zappa and people like that were some of my influences. I also really loved the 60s psychedelic bands from San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you give us a definition? Exactly what is punk rock? How would you define that?
Well, that's rather amusing because we spent a couple of days trying to figure that out recently because I'm doing a 3-part documentary series with my friend Don Bowles, who was the drummer from The Germs. And he and I are co-hosting a 3-part series on punk rock from San Francisco, L.A., and New York. And one of the things that we had to get to the bottom of was, what is punk? Ironically, it seems like you would know because of the look and everything. But actually, what we discovered was that punk it's kind of like a mutant gene. What it does is it causes other things to sort of deconstruct themselves. So punk is kind of a, when everything got too prissy in the mid-70s, punk was a deconstructive gene and kind of took it back down to like three-chord primitive music. Same thing in the graphic arts and in fashion. People were tearing up their T-shirts and putting safety pins. The idea was that it was like everything had gotten too nice, and they wanted some new rough kind of stuff.
Okay. Now how did you get off into the punk rock scene?
Well, I was already a survivor of the 60s. I was politically active in the 60s and did quite a bit of work then, but I was just a little bit young. And when punk rock came around, I was a little bit older than everyone else, so I had the opportunity to sort of go into it with my eyes open. Mm-hmm. And when that started, I saw the fashion, I saw the music. I really love hard rock. And I started to gather people together and bring a PA to the places and record people, and that creates community.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would like to play one of your songs that reflect the California punk rock scene. And then you can tell us a little about this song and how did it come about.
Thank you.
Tell us the name of that and talk about it a little.
Sure. That's a seminal punk band called the Mau Maus. And what's important about them is that there's a little historic story behind that, because Rick Wilder, the singer in the Mau Maus, was actually active even before the punk rock era. Around 1975, he had a hard rock band called the Berlin Brats, who I actually auditioned for. And even back then, he looked like a scarecrow, and I got just freaked out. I thought he was like some psycho junkie. And yes, the legend is unbelievable. But as it turns out, he's still alive, and he had these recordings that they had done in the past. Some of them were recorded with Ray Manzarek, the Doors mm-hmm. keyboard player. He had produced 5 songs, mm-hmm. and then someone else, I believe they produced 5 songs, and they brought me the whole package to mix the album. And so I did that recently. It's a recent punk rock mm-hmm. release of older material and newer material from a seminal kind of legendary punk rock mm-hmm. outfit.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the status of punk rock now on the scene?
I would say that punk rock influenced the culture quite a bit. Once again, it was sort of, like I said, kind of a recessive, destruction gene in a way. But the mm-hmm. point of that is that a lot of things, the sacred cows of society, really got sort of like lampooned through punk rock. And punk rock, as a result, never really got commercialized, and so it stayed underground. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was the punk rock style and the punk rock music went through a lot of different places. Currently, it's very, very big in the younger Latino community. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the older punk rock bands still are, seen as heroes. And there's a lot of new bands, too. And that's an important thing to remember, is that, those bands need to be heard.
Okay. Now, did punk rock, did it get a start in Europe England somewhere before it came over here to the States?
Punk rock was sort of manufactured in England by a very clever manager named Malcolm McLaren. But I think that at the time that that came out, we were all reading articles by a guy named Greg Shaw, who had a magazine called Bomp Magazine that was a big music magazine. And he talked about three-chord music, and he talked about punk rock in 1972. So I think he could be credited with kind of naming it.
Uh-huh. Now, did it develop differently on the East Coast as opposed to the West Coast? Is it two different? Is it two different types?
Yes, on the East Coast, it was there was the people involved were older. Here on the West Coast, it was a much younger thing, particularly in L.A., where there's a lot of skateboarders and surfers and stuff. So the kids really came in L.A., mm-hmm. and punk rock became a very, very hardcore youth movement here in L.A.
Yeah. Now, how about in the San Francisco area up north? Is
little
it different
old,
from down here?
A little bit older, a little bit more intellectual, a little bit more political, a little bit, you know how San Francisco is, and so it's kind of a lot more conscious, I guess you could say. But in L.A., we were interested in the fashion and the parties.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I'm also delighted to have with us in the studio, Larva, the wife of Gaysa X and a fashion designer. Larva, welcome to the Coomeron Report.
Oh, thanks. And I actually am a model, even though I went to school for fashion. But yeah. I know lots of designers and support them still.
Okay. Let's talk about that then. Can you tell our listening audience a little about your background and then how you got off into modeling and fashion and all of that?
Well, I got my sort of taste for that lifestyle when I was young. I started in ballet and was always very attracted to costumes. Halloween was my favorite holiday. So that's where I kind of got the taste for dressing up, becoming something fantastic for an audience, and receiving some sort of satisfaction from that. From there, I went to school for fashion here in Los Angeles at Otis College of Art and Design. And after that, I worked with a local fashion designer, Jared Gold, mm-hmm. and did that for several years until the company went through some changes. And I realized that making the clothes for me was not bringing joy. So creating the looks was more what I was interested in. So a friend suggested I model for artists, and that's sort of where I took off as an artist and have been doing that for years now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, now just exactly, well, how would you define fashion design as an art form?
Well, fashion, you know, the best way to describe it is fantasy. It's an instant way for someone to read you and see either what your personality is or what they want you to think their personality is. We are no longer in a society that needs to protect themselves from elements with our clothes as much as we have to protect our emotions. So I think fashion these days is more about what your fantasy is.
Mm-hmm. Does music influence fashion designing or vice versa? Fashion designer influence music?
I think,
what are your thoughts on that?
I think they're very heavily influenced by each other. I don't know if there's a beginning and an end. So most of the time it starts when you're a teenager. You start listening to music, and then you start dressing in clothes that you identify with because, you know, when you're 15, you're starting to pull away from the child role and into an adult role. So you start to fantasize about who you are as a person and how you can outwardly express that. And I think the best and only way these days for teenagers to do that is through fashion and music. So they're mm-hmm. they're very heavily dependent on each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Gaysa, for both of you, can you talk a little about Gaysa art? Because I see that that you're off into art, too. You've had a few art shows and all.
Thanks.
Can you talk a little about
that? Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. What happened was about 7-8 years ago, I've always been a photographer but sort of part-time hobbyist. And I took pictures of some, you know, musicians and stuff. But what happened was a few years ago, I started to print them up large on a big printer. And then after a while, I started gluing them to like Luan or wood, cutting them out and making outlines out of them. And so then I started showing them at some galleries, and I had the good fortune of being able to actually show and even sell a few pieces.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, let me ask you this. You know, one of the negative names that Los Angeles have is the homeless capital of the world, definitely in the United States, especially veterans. What do you think musicians and artists, how can they contribute in helping solve the homeless problem, especially among veterans?
Well, of course, that's a huge question that you know, could take many shows to even scratch the surface of, but I'll give it a shot. Mm-hmm. I drive through Skid Row every time I get a chance, and I'm very, very interested in what happens there. My feeling is that there are a number of things wrong, and the homeless situation is, I guess you could say, a symptom of multiple things. One of them is that we are, you know, deprived of culture, and we're deprived of work opportunities and all sorts of other things. So what's happened is that, you know, the homeless thing is just larger simply because there's, you know, more people that are being driven out of their homes. There's another situation, which is that L.A. has, unlike a lot of cities, L.A. has embraced its homeless population. And so other cities are starting to ship, unfortunately, their homeless here. The third thing that factors in is the fact that the missions and also some government agencies, they benefit from the poverty of the homeless. And so the more homeless that they can like say that they're helping, the more money that they get. So they create a situation that keeps the homeless nearby the missions on the streets. And I think that that's something that's got to be revised through some sort of central planning. So what musicians can do, of course, is they can go and do benefits. They can, you know, particularly successful musicians, they can show some support and bring attention. At this point, this is a problem that needs to have attention brought to it in a positive light, as opposed to just, oh, well, there's this huge homeless blight in downtown L.A., and the whole country doesn't really take it seriously. What we need to do is take a new look at it and look at the homeless as human beings and a possible resource, and at the homeless situation as not being just mission and government grant-driven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I've heard that term about the homeless problem have become like the homeless industrial complex, you know,
yes.
The military industrial complex, prison industrial complex.
Yes.
And one of the things I noticed about the homeless here in Los Angeles and downtown Skid Row in Hollywood is so many musicians, so many artists who become homeless. Do you think it's possible to, do you think they should be trying to develop like separate housing situation when it comes to artists?
Well, not necessarily, but I do think that the term homeless musician is kind of redundant because most of the musicians I've ever known have been either homeless or on the poverty line or somehow because they're musicians, they can kind of hustle up like the grasshopper and the ants, a little place to kick it. But basically, musicians are, you know, historically impoverished. And I've rarely been like, you know, more than a couple of inches off the street myself. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, can you talk a little about the Vortex, which is a multi-purpose community center located at 2341 East Olympic Boulevard, and then how did you get involved with it? And I'd like to give a shout-out to Jeff Parker and all of the staff over there at the Vortex and Cam.
That's right.
Cam up in New York.
Cameron in New York.
Yeah.
Cameron
so,
Melville.
Yeah. So tell us about the Vortex and how did you get involved.
Do you want to talk about that? The Vortex is a community center that's being operated as a nonprofit, and it took a while for the city of L.A. to really understand that we were serious about it because, of course, they're concerned about pop-up clubs and things like that. Mm-hmm. But what we're doing is we're running a legitimate community resource, which is a 400-occupancy theater space where people can come, and sometimes for just a few dollars or at the most $100 a night, have an event, a benefit or something, and as long as it's returning something to the community, some portion of the proceeds goes to a homeless shelter or a women's shelter or something like that, whatever, you know, moves you, it's pretty legit, and you can do your event there. So it's very friendly, but is designed mainly for the community groups to do local events.
Mm-hmm. Okay, beautiful location over there.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Yeah. Now, Lonnie, you want to say something about the Vortex? You want to?
Well, sure. It's a bigger thing than just having a space to do shows. This is a space that is redefining what art and creative type of people can do for their immediate community. Mm-hmm. Every time someone has an event in our space, they're bringing food for the homeless, or they're donating money, clothes, whatever they can do. So it's just a quick way for musicians to feel a part of something. And then, you know, the people benefiting from them see that, okay, there are people trying to help. You know, usually the kids that throw shows on at the Vortex are young. So to see young people supporting their community, it's pretty unheard of. You know, I'm a lot younger than Geza, and my generation is so apathetic because they have so many personal problems that they are unable to cope with the realities of their immediate neighborhoods. So you have this problem with highly creative and talented and resourceful people that are completely isolated or just apathetic to the point where they get angry if they see homeless people because they fought so hard for the little that they have. And then some guy that sees them sees how they're dressed. They might look cool. So that means they have money, but it's not. It means they're creative. And the homeless people don't know that the artists are one penny away from being homeless themselves.
Okay.
So you have a hot pocket of emotion in downtown LA. You have homeless seeing all these hipsters go out drinking, partying, you know, but that's their rent money. They don't know that, you know, so there's a lot of emotion day to day. You know, I'll pull into a fast food restaurant and I can't order without someone coming up to my window and asking for money. And as an artistic type, I feel compelled to give them money. But then I also know to train people to ask for money is sort of the problem also. So it's a big knot. And I think the best thing that artists can do is just say, how can I help in the smallest, most immediate, most effective way without putting myself out? Because usually artists are already strained to the max, you know, and if they're not, they're not downtown LA. They're in Hollywood.
Okay.
Right.
Now, Gay, so you are also a member of the D-Link, Downtown Los Angeles Neighborhood Council. What are some of your goals as a member of D-Link? Can you talk
about let me clarify. Yeah. I was I was almost sworn in, then I got sworn out, but I didn't get sworn at least. They have had some problems with the election process itself, and so they had difficulty filling some empty seats. I was going to be one of those empty seats, and I've made good friends with people all across the board of directors, but I'm not on the board yet. We're going to have a town hall meeting in a couple of weeks and do some new elections. But in the meantime, I have submitted proposals both to the to people in the both neighborhood councils, Boyle Heights and downtown LA, and my general plan is to do something to clarify the area directly surrounding the riverfront, because it's going to be going through a lot of changes in the next 10, 20 years, and it's a good idea to get there first with a specific plan. Otherwise, it's just going to be overtaken by developers.
Okay. All right, now let's take a short break for our community calendar, and then we open up our roundtable to our other guests.
This is the community calendar for the month of April. The Veterans Community Theater Workshop will be held this Tuesday, April the 23rd, from 5:30 to 8 p.m. It's free to the veterans and non-veterans. The workshop participants are currently working on writing individual stage plays and rehearsing the play Nailheads, also Surviving the Nickel. The location is the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard. This is near the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic, and the Metro bus number 60 and 66 stops near or close to the corner. For more information on the workshop, you can call 213-908-6587. Also, Tuesday, April the 23rd at 6:30 p.m., D-Link, that's Downtown Los Angeles Neighborhood Council, will have their monthly meeting, and the location is 653 South Spring Street. They're on the second floor, and this is in downtown Los Angeles. On Wednesday, April the 24th at 3 p.m., Drama Stage Qumran will perform excerpts from the stage play Nailheads. Nailheads is about 80,000 to 100,000 homeless people living on the streets of Los Angeles at any given night. Also, Drama Stage will host 28 visiting students from UCLA. The students will bring hygiene kits to distribute to the community of Skid Row. This event is located at the Lamp Community, 526 South San Pedro Street. Upcoming guests on the Qumran Report Monday, May the 6th, will be a representative from Hunger Action Los Angeles and also Nancy Mills of The Spirited Woman. If you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com. Attention, Earlene Anthony. And the call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our host.
Thank you, Miss Earlene Anthony. Now, we're back with our in-studio guests, Gaysa X and his wife, Lara, and joining us for our roundtable discussion is poet Dori Marlowe. Dori, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Can you tell us a little about your background?
Well, I was born in a small town outside of Philadelphia and lived there until 1973. When I came to L.A., I was hired to come to L.A. as a buyer for Orbox. I was a fashion buyer. And I worked for Orbox for some time. But I always was a writer and an artist. From my earliest days, I remember writing poetry. I've got one poem left when I was 7 years old. I was told that I used to lie on the living room floor with the Sunday papers when I was 5 or 6 and draw the cartoons. I would draw Brenda Starr and Prince Valiant and Little King. So I was always into that. I do have one watercolor that I did when I was about 7 or 8 years old. I still have that. But all my life, I've been into some kind of art. I always liked to write. I always liked to read. I always liked poetry. My early favorite poets were Rudyard Kipling and Emily Dickinson. And it just went on from there. When I came to L.A., as I said, I did it in my spare time. And then about 6 or 7 years ago, when I was retired, I just started writing and painting full time.
Okay. Nice. Who are some of the other artists, writers that influence you?
Well, I would say that these days I'm very, very into Neruda, Pablo Neruda. I love Neruda. I like Billy Collins, who was the poet laureate for some time. I'm really interested in Natasha Threadway, who's our current United States poet laureate. And Eloise Klein Healy, who's the Los Angeles poet laureate. Mm-hmm. And my poet partner, James Maverick. I think he's wonderful.
Oh, yeah. We know James.
We all know James, right? He's a wonderful poet. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people on the L.A. poetry circuit. Brendan Constantine is a wonderful poet, and so is Peggy Dobrier. Brendan, I host an open mic poetry reading twice a month in Studio City, and Brendan was supposed to be my guest next Sunday, but he is filling in now for Eloise Klein Healy, who's been ill for a while. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have Peggy Dobrier as our featured poet. It's an open mic. Anybody can come and read and do whatever they like. We tell them you can do anything you like. You can do stories, poetry, music. Just don't take off your clothes.
Now, let me ask you this. I hear this all the time. What is the difference between poetry and spoken word?
I think all of poetry, all of spoken word includes poetry, stories, essays. I mean, I've gone to poetry readings where people do political rants. It's spoken word. Whatever you do, spoken word goes way, way back. In fact, I think it was done 600 years before Christ. It's the Romans were doing it. The Greeks were doing it for spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a long, long, long historical tradition in literature.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, can you talk about your open mic program?
My open mic? Yeah. Oh, it's a wonderful thing. I'm also, by the way, I do want to divert for a moment because I want to address yes. one of the things you were talking about.
Yes.
I'm president of the Valley Watercolor Society, and I belong to about 6 or 7 art clubs. And one of the things the Valley Watercolor Society has been doing this year, by the way, and last year too, is we are donating art materials to the group called Free Art for Abused Children. And I'm sure you know about them. They're located downtown. They work with children who are being abused, who are abandoned, who are living in cars or shelters or on the street. And they take them in and they teach them art lessons, dance, poetry, music. And we all know that art heals.
Mm-hmm.
And my art club, the Valley Watercolor Society, every year does a drive, and we ask all of our members, we've got nearly 300 members, to bring in art materials, that which we donate to art. We had a whole van full of them this last drive. Okay. It was really nice. So I want to talk about that.
So she's actually touching, I'm sorry, but this is going to get good. She's touching on something that I think is so important. I come from a single mom, 4 kids, never had money. We had food stamps. Like, I've always been this close from being homeless. So my life changed when people from church would buy us Christmas presents because my mom couldn't afford it. Most of those Christmas presents were art supplies. I think my career in art
yes.
began out of charity. That's how powerful what we're talking about is. The miracle of creativity and expression is bigger than most things that the charities out there are offering. Anyway, so.
Beautiful.
And the children are important. They're the most important ones. Those little minds and little souls have to be developed. And when you give them things like that, it does heal them. It does help.
And this is what I want to ask open to the round table. How can we create more arts program, you know, music, paintings for our, you know, like more after school programs?
I can tell you that it's not going to come from the government.
Yes.
They're cutting back, and they're cutting back. Their big issues are things like the deficit, you know, and it's important. I don't say it isn't. But when it comes to the arts and the humanities, we suffer the most. And the only way it's going to be helped is we all individually come forward and do our part. That's the only thing I can say.
Okay.
And, you know, the arts, I'm from the fashion world, so I have experienced firsthand extreme waste.
Yes.
I think that the art community can tighten up 100% in that area. I live downtown, and I have about 4 to 5 dumpsters in my block that fill up every day with scraps of material. Every day I walk past that dumpster going, that could be a bed. That could be 50 pillows if just someone could sew it up. And so I think that giving art supplies is one part of it. And then also not wasting what we have so that we can share. And it just takes the initiative. I think so many artists are so bent on getting famous that they forget that they would get famous if they had more of a message.
Well, more of a message. What do you mean by, can you elaborate a little on that?
Well, I didn't see a lot of Bob Dylan types come out during the whole, the war, the election, the devastation that's hit our country and the whole world. You know, I don't see it reflected. I see people getting knocked down for it, actually. Pink. You know, there was that triple country, those 3 country singers in Texas that got bashed.
That's right.
So it was like anyone that was speaking up, and this is America, so we're allowed to up to a certain point, they got knocked down. And I thought that was the real sign of something that we need to fix.
Mm-hmm. There's a cultural backlash almost against protesting. It's as if we've lost our ability to organize and to complain, to, you know, petition the government as a redress of grievances, right? That's, you know, our right. And people have sort of, you know, I don't know, there's a very, very poor protesting kind of environment these days, and people are afraid to speak out.
Now, go ahead. Don't worry.
I was just going to say, I really agree with all of that because you mentioned Bob Dylan, but remember the days back in the late 60s and 70s when Bob Dylan and Joan Baez were writing songs. I mean, to this day, Bob Dylan's poetry and his music is relevant. He was predicting things that were going to happen 30, 40 years later. And as you said, we don't have that kind of thing today. You know, we don't have as many of those. But I know that as a poet, I was very influenced by Bob Dylan's work and by Joan Baez and by Odetta. I loved all of those artists in those days. And I think they had, more than being talented, they had a message. They had a mission. And it's really something that we could use again.
Well, that might be where the homeless come in. They have the soul and something to express. So if we can get them the skill and some resources, we have our message. You know, here it is from the mouth of the person who's experiencing the trauma instead of some celebrity Beyonce type who I doubt has spent a lot of time in Skid Row, but I doubt it. And, you know, just start right out in front of your front door. You don't have to go much farther than that. A lot of young kids I hang out with are so, you know, into their routine of going to work and then weekends going out to the nightclubs. And that's pretty much their life for about 15 years until their health starts to decline. And then they start worrying about politics.
Now, how about the Occupy movement? What are your thoughts on that?
That's interesting. I have a poem about it, and I didn't bring it with me. I do have a poem about that whole issue of you know, our misplaced values, how we don't value the things that are the people around us, the children. And instead, you know, we have people from that are, you know, outrageously obnoxious TV stars who are collecting obnoxiously high salaries, and it's just over the top sometimes. There's an imbalance. There's a certain imbalance, I think.
Those people don't represent us is the thing, they're among the wealthy and the successful. They're the ones that are helping make the rules and call the shots. So those people don't really represent us, and that's what we have to understand. There was a time perhaps in the 60s when music was sort of a voice of change, but that's not the case anymore. And we have to always remember that because we have had it systematically sold to us that is what's going on, but it's not anymore.
And, you know, back to the Occupy movement, I remember when I went down to the city hall when they were down there with the tents, and I noticed that this is where you had a mixture of politics, fashion, art, and all like that. Do you think that was an opportunity to make a statement?
Personally, I love Occupy. I was with it, and I was following it very, very closely on the web. And I went down to the town hall meetings, but I had a problem with them because what it was I found that a lot of the crazies were out, you know, pretty much guiding it this way and that. And so what happened is it took a long time or forever for them to try to make any decisions, and not a whole lot happened as a result of that. Okay. So I didn't like it, like, on the spot. I also thought there was obviously the homeless need to represent, but there was a really strong sort of just a street roughneck kind of element, so that the politics got it somewhat swallowed up in that too.
I think it was a strong attempt, but I don't think we have the ability to stand up for our freedoms and our rights anymore. I think that got dumbed down through television. I was following the Occupy movement, but I come from a very cautious background, and I didn't want to go down there. I didn't see the point. I didn't think that what I was going to do was going to make a difference. Gaze, on the other hand, was all for it. He's been through protests during the 60s. He saw how it could help. I come from the 90s. I'm apathetic. I don't see the point. So that was how I felt when it was going on. Now that the dust has settled, everyone has their opinions about it, I see that that was just the beginning of something very important, which is the youth is now able to educate themselves. They didn't get the education they needed in school. So they are going on the internet, finding out the information, making their own decisions. And I'm talking about the 20-year-olds, not the 30-year-olds. The 30-year-olds are already mm-hmm. jaded. The 20-year-olds now have been growing up with the internet, have been growing up with political topics being very hot and popular. Mm-hmm. And I think the celebrities kind of showed up during the election. So we had a little bit of that. And now the Boston tragedy, mm-hmm. we have more celebrities. So I think this is generating something that will show up in 10 to 15 years mm-hmm. if it gets organized. The okay. organization is the key.
Okay, we're going to get off into a couple poems in a minute. I want to ask Gaysa another question, though. Do you think, because during the time that the punk rock scene took off, you didn't have the internet around. Do you think that would have influenced or changed the whole concept of punk rock?
That's interesting because I sort of was asking myself a similar question the other day. I can't tell. It was a different kind of thing. It was almost like the last sort of analog movement, you know, if you want to call the new ones digital. It's hard to say. I think that it was right before video, too. So you can see that it was right on the line between those two things. I don't know. If
I think promotion would have been different.
Would have been mm-hmm. different.
Yeah.
Okay. And, Dory, let me ask you this about the whole world, the artistic world of poetry and all, since it's been around such a long time.
Yeah.
What's the influence on the internet in terms of the art?
Oh, that's interesting because there are open mic poetry readings and they are on the internet. They're on, there's like talk radio. There's one in called the Cobalt Cafe in Topanga. And the young man who runs that, Rick Lupert, has this daily online poetry reading. In fact, he has contests, selects the poet of the month, and you read your poetry and you're listed, your words are listed. And he does this internet thing where you call in mm-hmm. a radio show that you call in.
Okay.
So there is a lot of that going on. I think the internet is very, very influential in the spoken word, in the written word.
Okay. Now tell us, you're getting ready to do a few poems.
Well, when you mentioned apathy, I have this one little short poem that I have to read, okay? Yeah. And it's called Apathy. They carry handmade protest signs. They crouch in tents at nightfall, endure police attacks. The people occupy. Let me sleep another 10 minutes. The children watch deputies pile toys and possessions on the curb. The mother weeps. Let me sleep another 15 minutes. The young man in uniform leans on his cane with one leg, a long line at the VA hospital. Benefits handed out sparingly. Let me sleep another 20 minutes. The shelter is full. Friends wrap their arms around each other. Where shall we sleep? Please let me sleep. Let me sleep till it's over. Let me not see. Let me close my eyes and my ears. It's not my problem.
Okay. Wow. Perfect.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Also, I just want to remind people this is National Poetry Month.
Yes, it is.
Oh, yes,
that's right. Poetry Month.
Yeah, but can you talk about apathy? What's the background motivation for it?
I just always wish that people wouldn't just turn their backs and say, you know, apparently the person who's writing this poem is saying, I just want to sleep through it. I don't want to see it. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to know about it. And we know people like that. But on the other hand, I know a lot of people who really get involved and they really do things. And I'm very, very enthralled with that kind of motivation or that kind of action that people take. Maybe they think sometimes, people think, oh, what can you do? It's just such a big problem. Everything you do helps. Every little bit helps. Mm-hmm. You know, it only takes one drop of kindness to have another drop of kindness follow it. That's all it is kindness and being aware of the plight of your fellow human being.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, okay. you have these kids that have things and have money, and they're so depressed and so bored that they'd rather go take drugs and have sex than go feed the homeless. But that's right. Exactly what would cure their depression and boredom. Mm-hmm. You know, as if they did something for someone else. It's something that once you experience it, you know it's true. When I give money to a homeless guy and I see his face light up like, oh, man, mm-hmm. I don't have to worry for two more hours about what I'm going to eat, where I'm going to go. I can take the bus, you know, and I don't do it all the time. But I know for a fact that there's a point where you have to ask yourself, what's the ethical thing to do as opposed to the popular thing to do? And I think that the younger we start, you know, with the kids, getting them into the creative world, letting them know there's a way to express themselves without violence, without drugs, without sex, you know, I'm all for that stuff. But when there's such a dependency on it and there's such a great solution like creativity, I mean, poetry is still relevant. I mean, rap is poetry. And so we're not talking about old fashioned kind of things here. You know, I'm fairly young and I still believe the power of poetry, of punk rock music, of fashion as a way to solve the world's problems. And I think if we continue to focus on organizing, then we can put a dent into something that's been around since the dawn of man.
I agree with that. I would like to say that what I consider my style or my poetry style is that I write a lot what I call slice of life poetry.
Okay.
Slice of life on any level. As I said, the homeless people or the I write this poem Apathy, but I also write about romance. I'm very, very romantic. I happen to be in love.
Me too.
Give us another one of your poems.
Another
one?
Next one. Okay. And I am an artist. This is called The Artist, okay? You walk by her easel and take no notice, her presence unremarkable. The park, dressed for summer, showers your senses green. She sits in the shade. Her flowered skirt mirrors the landscape. Brushes swirl with color. She is small and busy. Her fragile fingers steady. The images dance with emotion. Her canvas tells her story. A tantalizing passion burns inside her ancient elegance. Do you know her dreams? Once she had lovers. A fragile bird, her wings now silvered and understated, she remembers the contours of one who left his fragrance on her sheets, her body, and ultimately on her soul. A symphony of sensation. His hungry lips trace her velvet thighs, wild and wet their love. That year, he lay by her side, his kiss wholly upon her mouth. As vital as air, she aches still for his touch. She remembers sleep with the sound of his voice, while two hearts meet as their life force flowed into one another. Taunting memories, an artist now, she paints and dreams.
Wow.
Okay. Give us one more short poem.
Okay, one more short one.
And then we begin to wind
down. Okay, this one's called The Hypnotist.
Oh, okay. So.
You walked in with your Tracy Chapman wail and your Merlot mouth and the floor tilted like the funhouse on the Atlantic City Pier. I'd seen your kind before in a Denzel Washington movie. But baby, I dove in anyway. You ran yourself through my veins like a chemotherapy kick on strawberry cheesecake. And you lit the Christmas lights on Keith Jarrett's ivories and taught me to breathe. You sent my soft spots to the bottom of the cure. Your sweet voice made me want to fly while your kiss broke me free. The night became liquid. We were caught in a tidal wave, and in the morning, I was all purple silk and royal right down to my toes. Your good looks left an outline on my bed like chalk at a crime scene. Repeat after me. Step away from the poem. This table is reserved for lovers.
Great.
Look, Dory, can you give us again, give us the basic information about the venue, you know, when do you do it?
Oh, it's
time,
the second
location.
It's the second and last Sunday of every month. It's held at a place called The Coffee Fix, excuse me. And James Maverick, who is my poet partner, and I produce it and host it. We call it The Poetry Fix. We have a guest poet every time we read, and we have an open mic. Each reader gets about 7 minutes, depending on how many signups we get. It lasts from 5 till about 7:30. We start sign-ups around 4:30. And we get a really nice crowd there.
Okay.
Really nice crowd.
Is that 12508 Moore Park
Street? Yes, 12508 Moore Park Street in Studio City.
Okay.
And you can do more than just poetry. Some people come and sing. You know, mm-hmm. some people come and do comedy, stories, mm-hmm. whatever you'd like to do there. It's really a fun place. It's sort of open.
Okay. Now, okay, so a couple of quick things I want to ask you before we close out. Can you think of any modern music or movies that reflect the punk rock scene?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't. I can't think of anything offhand. I'm sorry. I don't really watch that many.
Now, how about young punk rock artists that's out now?
That's another thing. Is that there's sort of different generations. It's like some people think of Green Day and stuff like that when they think of punk rock, and Green Day was sort of a later band that did a very good kind of rendition of punk. Mm-hmm. The most up and coming bands really are in the sort of like the Latino hoods. You know, they come out with the young bands about age 15 to 18 and 20. Mm. And that's really a lot of punk rock is coming out of there now.
Yeah, so they're sort of like redefining the art form. Okay. Now, how about among African Americans? Is the punk rock scene anything?
It's always surprised me because it always seemed like, you know, there was like a relatively limited African American presence in punk rock. But one of the best punk rock bands ever was the Bad Brains. Okay. And they were all black.
Okay. The Bad Brains?
Yeah, the Bad Brains were a really good band. They're from Washington, D.C., I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful. Nice to know.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go around for some closing comments and make sure we have a contact information for those that would want to contact you. Let's start with Laura. The closing comments?
Well, I just want to thank you guys for holding space for us. I think this is a conversation that needs to keep happening with more and more artists, and we're just getting started. Please come see us at the Vortex. You can get a hold of me on Facebook under Larva La Larva. And thank you so much.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks very much. I can be reached at Geza, G-E-Z-A, at vortexla.org.
All right.
I also want to thank you both very much. And I met you both, I think it was a few weeks ago at the Arts Share. It was a wonderful night, and it was really lovely to meet you there. Thank you for inviting me. You can reach me also on Facebook, or you can reach me on my email, which is Dori Marler, my name, DoriMarler, at yahoo.com.
All right. Now, I would like to extend a special thanks to Geza X and his wife, Lava, poet Dori Marler, my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Please listen to past shows of the Qumran Report on iTunes, Facebook, and skidrow.la. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. And from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with the song that opened the show, I Hate Punks, by Geza X and the Mama Men.
Thank you.
Thanks.